you each one for coming out and or joining us virtually. So it's good to be here in Apopka, Florida. All was very, very quiet in the DeRose household. I was just a little boy, 8 or 10 years of age at the time, and when I was sure that everyone in the house was asleep, I quietly slipped out of my bed. I made my way across my bedroom, past my brother's bed, and then into the hallway. From there, I was headed to the stairs, because there was only a single destination on my mind, the kitchen. And so it was that I walked ever so carefully down those steps into the main level of the house, and then on my way to the kitchen. And there it was. There it was, that large metal canister, the cookie jar. Now, I don't know if you've ever dealt with a metal cookie jar, but if you're going to sneak into the cookie jar, you've got to do it ever so carefully. And so that night, I lifted the lid up. I reached in. David, what are you doing in the cookie jar? Yeah, I jumped too. It was Mom. And I don't know how she knew it, but she found me going into the cookie jar. And she gave me a message that went something like this. David, don't you know that eating cookies in the middle of the night is not good for you? Now, I didn't realize it at the time. But in my mind, a connection was developing. Tastes good, bad for me. Now, in that very same DeRose household, I had two parents that loved me very much. And by all indications, they still do. In fact, I was visiting them just a few days ago. They're not far from here in the Villages. But when I was a kid, they had some strange ideas about my future, like this bit about wanting me to grow up, strong, healthy. I mean, it's a dangerous thing to talk about right now because, you know, you could look at me and you could say they didn't succeed or they did, but that's immaterial. They had these goals for me. And one of the things that went along with it was, well, it was giving me this stuff on my plate. Green leafy vegetables. And I'm trying to tell you with all the enthusiasm that I had as a young kid growing up. Now today, don't misunderstand me. If you invited me to your home and you had some kale or collards, I'd probably have second, maybe even third servings of it. But back then, I mean, I was doing really good if I was just kind of moving those green leafy vegetables around my plate. But sooner or later, my father would turn to me. And he'd say something that went like this. David, eat those greens. They're good for you. And again, I didn't realize it. But another connection was developing in my brain. Tastes bad, good for me. You got it. Some of you nod. Some of you even finished the words. And you laugh, because why? Most of us have grown up with this false dichotomy. We'll talk about it in a few minutes, but let me just paint the picture. We've got a group of things in our minds that are healthy, and what kind of adjectives do we often attach to those healthy habits? Maybe dull, boring, tasteless. I'm just speaking historically. Am I right? Or is it just me that grew up that way? And then what about the, unhealthy things? What kind of adjectives often go along with those? Fun, exciting. My kids have heard me give this talk. I've given it on a number of occasions. And once they had come across a magazine, and this was some years ago, and they said, Dad, here's exactly what you're talking about. There was a picture of all these desserts, and it said, decadently delicious. Interesting, isn't it? But I've already suggested to you, it's a false dichotomy. We really don't have to choose between being happy and being healthy. The medical research actually shows that the same lifestyle promotes both. Let me tell you about one of the researchers that did some of the introductory work on this topic. I had the privilege of meeting him. In fact, we were both speakers at the National Wellness Conference some years ago. His name, Dr. Lester Breslow. Dr. Lester has now passed from the scene of action, but Dr. Breslow, one of the great public health champions in our country. Back in the 60s, he was the head of the California State Department of Health. He was an MD, and he had a crazy idea. I say it was a crazy idea because he told the story there at Stevens Point, where we were having this conference. Well, let me just tell you about the story. He had this idea that if he recruited a group of people, we call it a cohort, and followed them over time, he could actually show a connection. Now, I know this may sound wild. What may sound wild about it is just how crazy people thought it was in the 60s. He had this idea that if he got a group of people and looked at how they lived, he could predict when they would die. Now, right now you say, well, that's obvious, right? I mean, we all know this. But let me just tell you how radical this was back then. Some of you were alive in the 50s and 60s. That was an era when we were going to conquer everything through medical technology, right? We were getting ready to put a man on the moon, right? What else was going on? It would just be a little bit longer when President Nixon was going to proclaim a war on cancer. We were going to get rid of cancer. It was all American ingenuity. We were going to conquer everything. Didn't matter how you lived. So what if you messed up your heart? There was heart bypass surgery. We were basically conquering the world, if you will, through technology. It had nothing to do with the choices you were making. No, really, go back in time, the early 60s. Doctors, many of them smoking. Advertisements on television, in every magazine for cigarettes. It was in the around 64, 65 when the Surgeon General first came out with a proclamation that cigarette smoking was actually linked to lung cancer. So this is the context. It's before that publication. And so Breslow invited the National Institutes of Health to fund this innovative research study. Now, this was in the days before concerns for conflict of interest and, you know, inappropriate social interactions. The research team there in the Bay Area of California hosted NIH investigators. They socialized together for 3 whole days. Breslow told us the story. And at the end of those 3 days, they said, Breslow, you're crazy. We're not giving you a penny. That would have been the end of the story if it weren't for the fact that some folks at the National Cancer Institute heard about Lester Breslow's idea, and ultimately a few years later, they funded the Alameda County Health Study. About a decade later, 1970, the first publication, at least that I'm aware of, rolled off the press from this cohort of some 7,000 individuals. And they found that just following simple lifestyle habits could make a 2- to 4-fold difference in whether you lived or whether you died over the course of a decade. What were those habits? Well, things that you yawn about when I tell you right now. One of them was indeed cigarette smoking. If you're a non-smoker, you're more likely to live. Eating breakfast was one of those factors. Not eating between meals. Not carrying extra weight. Exercising regularly. As you're listening to the list, some of you are starting to say, I'm confused. Hey, you started by saying we don't have to choose between being happy and being healthy, and now you're going over these same things that sound like I've got to make that choice because I don't like to exercise and I don't like to eat breakfast. And if you're telling me I can't eat between meals, that is going to really make my life miserable. Well, I'm telling you about the Alameda County study because the study didn't stop in 1970. They continued to follow that population, not just for a decade, not just for two, but they continued to follow this cohort over time. And one of the publications that came out from that group was an amazing one, because they started to look not just at longevity, they started to look at quality of life. They started to look at risk of disability. And you know what they found? They found the very same habits that helped you live longer helped you live better. And this is the message of countless studies now today, that you don't have to choose between living longer and living better. It's the same lifestyle that promotes both. And I begin that way tonight, because when it comes to behavior change, really that's where it all starts. You've got to make the decision that it's really worthwhile changing. And what I find happens to many people, I know because I've sat with them in the medical office. I've visited with them at lectures. They've called in to my radio show when it was a call-in show. And they've said things like, well, but I'm doing everything so good. I've got to have a few bad habits. Doctor, but I've got to do something for fun. Well, this is not supported by the medical research literature. If you want the highest quality of life, if you want the most enjoyable life, you want to embrace the healthiest lifestyle. And you say, but that's a problem, because I don't like the healthiest lifestyle. And that really brings us to the topic for tonight. How do we change those habits that we identify as bad? And how do we change them for good? Well, one of the secrets that we've learned in medical science is an interesting one. It's not necessarily a comfortable one, but we all know about it. It has to do with this. The most powerful decisions are all or none decisions. All or none decisions. And especially when there is an addictive component involved. We mentioned cigarette smoking. How many of you think a successful strategy would be to tell a smoker just to cut down? No, it's good. I mean, smoking less is better. But they really never break free of something that with the very first cigarette of the day will raise your blood pressure. Do you know how much? How much does the first cigarette of the day raise your blood pressure? Well, let me make sure I'm telling you the truth. I'm going to resort to a best-selling book on the topic, 30 Days to Natural Blood Pressure Control. Some of you may know one of the authors. His name is Dr. David DeRose. And I'm looking here. Okay, here we are. 25 points. 25 points. That's the first cigarette of the day. You say, well, wait a minute. I don't have a problem with high blood pressure, and I don't smoke. Where are you going with this? My point is simply this. Even a single cigarette is harmful. So for the person who wants to break free of cigarettes, they've got to set their goal for what? None. Zero. How about the alcoholic? What do we recommend they do? Do we say, maybe a beer on special occasions? What do we say? We say zero, right? But what about us? What about our other behaviors that we don't often label as addictive? Let me tell you my own story. Because some of you think, oh, well, here's this guy, perfect lifestyle all his life. Of course, he's going to come and tell us that what he's doing is good and what we're doing is bad. Well, I'll tell you a bit about my lifestyle. When I was growing up, I had a number of interesting habits. Now, some people today, they're worried about these things that we carry around. A lot of us, have these smartphones, right? And people are worried that they're following us, okay? That they're tracking all our behaviors and things. And sometimes, of course, I do wonder when I turn my phone on and it says, 21.5 minutes to the Apopka Church. I said, how did they know I was going there? Anyway, okay? But long before there were any smartphones, I realized that they were actually tracking me. Really, it was kind of chilling to think back on what was going on. There was this restaurant that I used to go to, my favorite restaurant probably, or at least among them, and they had a billboard there. And when I think back on it, they were actually tracking my behavior because they first had something on there that said something like 100 sold, and then it changed to thousands. And as I kept going, it went up to tens of thousands and millions and billions. Are any of you following along with this? Are you relating to this? Maybe you didn't have this restaurant down here, but it had these like gold humps or, do you know what I'm talking about? Golden arches, yes. McDonald's, you remember, right? Did they have those around here too? Do you remember this where they were tracking people's consumption? And so I was frequenting the fast food restaurants. So I know I may be disqualifying myself in some of your eyes, but that wasn't the worst of it. One of the worst habits I had is I could not go to bed at night unless I had some sweet food. It was usually ice cream or cake. Maybe it was cookies, okay? So didn't have that, I was not going to bed. Some of you are thinking, wait, this guy's talking to us about health? I'm just telling you where I've come from, okay? So you can understand. Now, I'm going to be honest with you. I don't want to paint too bleak a picture, but I actually did have some good habits. Remember I told you, even Breslow had found that eating breakfast was a healthy habit, and I was doing that. I was a regular breakfast eater. I remember, even in high school. That's a lot of times when kids aren't eating real well. And I've got to be honest with you, every day when I got off that school bus at my high school, I went right to the cafeteria and right to the Coke machine and the candy bar machine. And I always had a candy bar and Coke every morning. No, really, that was my lifestyle. So I'm just telling you, if you think I can't relate to where you're at, I probably can. And I haven't told you the half of it. But let me tell you what happened to me. And we're in a church, so I can tell you this. Some people wouldn't understand it. But there came a time in my life, I was an agnostic as a young man, didn't know if there was a God or not, but God was getting my attention. And I came to the conclusion that he actually was interested in my health. And he started talking with me, not audibly, but suggesting that there were some things in my lifestyle that needed to change. Now, I don't know how any of you respond to those kind of dialogues, but I wasn't real excited about it, but I was getting this clear idea that God really wanted me to care better for my health. I actually, even as a young man, had lots of health issues, lots of digestive problems. I was actually sicker back then than I am now. And some of you say, well, no surprise, the way you were living. Okay, but anyway, so I'm getting this idea that all this sugar I'm eating is not a good thing. And even before I had my medical doctor's degree or my master's in public health, you give credit to the Holy Spirit, however you want to do it, but I was under the conviction I had to make a clean break with the sugar. I just had to get rid of it. I had to stop eating the cakes and the cookies. And I know some of you are saying, well, this sounds very extreme. This sounds crazy. But I believe that's what I needed to do. And I took it so seriously. The Lord helped me to do it. I believe that. And I would even read labels on things like Cheerios. I mean, that's a very low sugar cereal. There aren't too many cereals that have as little sugar as Cheerios. But I saw on that packaging sugar, I wouldn't even eat that. And so I started going on this path. And after a few years, I found myself in a very interesting setting. I was a member of a singing group. So you might be surprised to hear that. You say, now, wait a minute. Why didn't you let us know that you were a singer? You know, we could have had a larger crowd here. You know, you could have done a concert prior to the health talk. Well, let me just tell you the kind of singing that I did and the kind of audiences I had. I realized that I may not be the most gifted singer, so it was not a singing group that you had to audition for. They basically took anyone who wanted to sing, and we would sing only for a select groups of people. Back in that era, we called them shut-ins, okay? So these were individuals, usually they were disabled, maybe they were in, we called them nursing homes back then, you might call them an extended care facility today, and we'd go to group homes where they were being cared for by others, and we would sing to these folks. Well, on one of these occasions, it was our first visit to a group home, and we're singing there, and unbeknownst to us, as we're singing, some of those caregivers were so touched by our music ministry. I don't know if it was how harmonious the words and the music were, but they were touched enough that they disappeared, unbeknownst to us, into the kitchen. And in that kitchen, there was a large silver platter that they took down. And they put onto the silver platter these festive party plates. Onto the plates, they put cookies. And onto each plate, a scoop of ice cream. Okay? So here they come out with this plate. And they come out as we're finishing our performance. Now, I'll give you a little bit more context. At the time of this story, I'm now a medical student, so I'm connecting more of the dots. And here they come with this tray. Now, I will tell you one other detail. To this point in my life, I had never given a health lecture. Never. So how many of you think here is the ideal opportunity for Dr. Tabi DeRose's first health lecture? He could say, no one should be eating cookies and ice cream. How many of you think that was an ideal opportunity for me to start my health lecturing career? I see a few people raising their hands, or at least one person. Well, it may have been an ideal opportunity, but for some reason, I thought I was just supposed to be the gracious recipient of their hospitality. And so I look at the plate in front of me, ice cream and cookies, two of my favorite foods that I had not eaten for several years now. So what was I going to do? Well, I actually really didn't want to eat them. And so I kind of looked around. The fellow next to me was a bit older and wiser. He already had his medical doctor's degree. And I noticed what he did when he thought nobody was looking. He took the cookies and he put them in his pocket. I followed suit. Cookies in pocket. But how many of you have ever tried to slip ice cream into your pocket? Yeah, I realized that was not going to work. So what was I going to do with the ice cream? I decided I would eat it ever so slowly. So, you know, the cookies are already gone, and if I'm eating the ice cream slowly, yeah, I'd eat some of it, but the rest of it would melt, and it would look like I was so happy to receive their kindness. And so that's what I did. I started eating my former favorite food. And as I ate it, I'm telling you the truth, I was starting to get nauseated. It was so sweet and so fatty that I was feeling sick. And as I walked out of that house, it was like this stroke of illumination that my tastes had changed. Now, this is nothing that I just discovered. It's something that's well documented in the medical literature. In fact, I have a good example of it in our book, 30 Days to Natural Blood Pressure Control. It's found at chapter 5, where we talk in detail about nutrition and its relationship to blood pressure. If you actually have the book, I see some of you got a head start and picked one up as you came in. Figure 5:17. So if you've got your copy here, you can shine tonight, because you will be able to tell the group, this is a study, a classic study published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, that looked at what happened to salt preferences when people adopted a low sodium diet. Cut your sodium intake in half. By the way, that's a dramatic decrease. And how will food taste? How will it taste? It's going to taste bad. You got it? You're not used to it. But what they found is after a week, salt preference had decreased about 10%. And as they followed these people over time, it took a full 3 months before they had firmly established a new normal, a desire for those low sodium foods. Now what would happen if you gave them the high sodium option that they used to enjoy so much? They would find it distasteful. So that trajectory can be different for different habits. But the point is, catch it. This is the most powerful health education principle. It's that you are created with the ability to choose what you will enjoy. That's right. The things you habitually choose become the foods that you enjoy. The lifestyle practices you habitually engage in, those are the things you develop an enjoyment for. I talked with you earlier about cigarette smoking. I've helped many people stop smoking. And virtually every one of them, there's a few exceptions if they grew up in a cloud of smoke with two parents smoking or something like that, but most everyone tells me when they first had a cigarette, it was what? Repulsive. It made me cough. I got nauseated. I vomited. Well, then why in the world did they keep smoking? Because their friends were doing it. Or it was cool, or they were going to show that their parents weren't going to tell them what to do. And so what did they do? They stuck with it until what happened? They developed a new enjoyment. I mean, this is amazing. I mean, think about it. You actually have the capacity to develop new enjoyments. When this finally dawned on me, I said, no, wait a minute. If I can enjoy any lifestyle, why don't I just pick the best one? I mean, does that sound like such a crazy idea? If we could really enjoy anything, why not do that? Now, when I tell audiences that or when I tell a patient that, he or she might say, well, but I've tried that. But how do we usually try to improve our lifestyle? What I've noticed is most people haven't caught that all or none decision-making power. Right? What does it look like when you say, I'm eating too much sugar? Well, typical person says, I'm going to cut back. Okay? I'm going to eat less ice cream. Let's take a fake case history. Anyone here named Esmeralda? No? Okay, we'll use the name Esmeralda. Okay, so let's say Esmeralda has some problems. She has diabetes, uncontrolled, high blood pressure. She's overweight, heart disease, and she weighs 600 pounds. Okay? And she's only 5 feet tall. How many of you would say this is not sounding like a real good health picture? You following along with me? So Esmeralda goes to see the dietitian, and the dietitian gets a diet history. And as she's sitting down with Esmeralda, our friendly dietitian says, Esmeralda, do you realize you are eating about 4 pounds of chocolate a day? And she says, no, I never thought about it. Just whenever I want chocolate, I eat it. And she said, that's obvious. Okay, so Esmeralda putting away 4 pounds of chocolate a day. Now let me ask you a question. Do you think it would benefit her health to cut down to 1 pound a day? It would, right? I mean, a whole lot less sugar, a whole lot less fat. This would be a benefit to her. How about if she cut back to just one Snickers bar a day? Would that be even better? Sure it would be. How about if she just cut back to one Snickers bar a week? I mean, now you're talking, right? Here's the problem with that, though. Remember, Esmeralda wasn't thinking at all about chocolate. She was just eating it whenever she wanted. If she cuts down to one Snickers bar a week, what's going to happen? That's right. All she's going to be thinking about is chocolate. She'll eat that Snickers bar, and then she'll be looking at her watch. Okay, only 6 days, 23 more hours and 15 minutes, and I can have my next Snickers bar. Right? What is her life going to be consumed by? Deprivation. Oh, poor me. I wish I didn't have weight problems. I wish I was like my sister. I wish I didn't have diabetes. Then I could go back to eating all the chocolate like I used to. And what happens? Her desire for the chocolate can actually increase. Isn't that crazy? So here, we think we're on a journey to better health, and all we're doing is making ourselves more miserable. And by the way, if you're making yourself more miserable, What is it likely you're doing to your family? Maybe it's your fellow church members. When you see them eating some things that you know you shouldn't be eating, well, you may want to let them know they shouldn't be eating it either. And after all, you're not all that nice about it because you're feeling pretty miserable. Help us, right? Help us. So what's the solution? Well, I can tell you in a place of worship that the best solution I can give you is to ask God what he wants you to change. Don't ask him what he wants your husband to change, or your wife, or your son, or your daughter, or your fellow church member, or your next door neighbor. Ask him what he wants what? You to change. And here's the amazing thing that I found. God really does care about people, and he's not going to ask you to change something that he's not fully committed to have you accomplish. I have three children. How many of you think when they were growing up, I liked to give them gifts? I mean, I think every parent, you know, likes to give gifts. How many of you think maybe I came home once from a trip with some gifts for my children? I said, kids, I want to give you these gifts, but before I give them to you, all I want you to do, just do something simple. Show me, you know, your love for me. You just take a running start, and I want you to jump over the house, and I'll be on the other side with the gifts. How many of you think I was a dad like that? What would you call that? You say that's cruel, right? Have you ever seen the kid, the dog, you know, the little, you know, miniature chihuahua or something, and he's holding the treats, you know, like 6 feet up, and the dog maybe can jump pretty high, but, you know, 3 feet is really high for one of those miniature chihuahuas, but it's not going to jump 6 feet. And when you see that happening and the kid laughing, what do you think? I mean, you might think, well, that's being kind of mean. You know, why don't you give the dog the treat instead of torturing it? And if you're a parent or a grandparent, you might even tell the child that. But give the dog the treat. What kind of a God do we serve? Does God do that? Does he ask us to do something that's impossible? No. Well, maybe in ourselves it might be, but he's there to help us. So what I challenge people, we're speaking about this concept of changing bad habits for good. If you want the most powerful decisions, they're not decisions that you dream up yourself or even that your doctor gives you. It's a decision that you embrace, and like I'm saying, we're in a faith community. Some of you may be members of this faith community, others of you may not be, but if you're a person of faith, ask God what he wants you to change, and I can guarantee you he will give you the strength to do that. But the most powerful decisions are all or none decisions, okay? How many of you have read this story, a famous story? There's this mountain. It's thundering and lightning. There's this, you know, it's amazing setting. And there's these, it says God himself is there. And he's speaking the ten command. Are you sure they're commandments? You sure? Are you sure they weren't the 10 suggestions? Now, have you ever thought about this? Why didn't God give 10 suggestions? Now, just stop for a minute. I mean, I'm not trying to be disrespectful here. But I've noticed that my patients prefer me to give them suggestions or advice rather than to give them commandments. And my guess would be, if there are people close to you in your life, you prefer when they give you suggestions or advice rather than commandments. Am I right? So why did God give commandments? Why didn't he just give suggestions? Why didn't he say, I mean, don't you think in that era there might have been people that, well, could have even been serial killers? Is that possible? If there's a serial killer, wouldn't it be good for him to cut back dramatically on his killing? What do you think? I mean, wouldn't that save a lot of lives? So why thou shalt not kill? Well, this isn't a theological discussion, but from a behavioral discussion, there is no power in cutting back. There's no power in cutting back. Okay? How do you know how much to cut back? How well are you doing? Well, I did less than last week. I must be doing pretty good. The real power is all or none decisions. So all of the commandments are spoken in terms of all or none decisions, and rightly understood, they're promises. God is asking his people to live in a certain way, and it's a God who cares for them and wants their best, and he's basically saying, I'm committed to help you live this kind of a lifestyle. Say, okay, fair enough. We don't have to choose between being happy and being healthy. We can accomplish both by adopting the healthiest lifestyle. We can make lifestyle changes. We can make lasting behavioral changes if we make all or none decisions. But then why is it so difficult? Why do we fail? Well, one of the reasons I'd suggest to you is that we reward ourselves. And we often reward ourselves with the wrong things. Okay? True story. Some years ago, I was working in a residential lifestyle change facility. We'd have people come live with us for a week to 3 weeks. We'd help them change their lifestyle to address their conditions. This particular individual was a government leader, had come to our center. This fellow had bad diabetes. While he was with us, his diabetes came under control. He was off his diabetes medications. We were not feeding him, though, all his favorite foods. We were feeding him a very specialized diet, and the expectation was that if he was impressed with his results, he would continue that diet at home. Well, having foregone some of his favorite foods, like fried fish, on his way back home, he decided to reward himself. That's right. And what are you going to reward yourself with after working so hard and accomplishing so much? What kind of reward was he going to give himself? Fried fish. And that was the beginning of going right back to his old lifestyle and back on all his insulin and on a trajectory for all his diabetic complications. So don't reward yourself with things that will undermine your resolve. Don't reward yourself with the very things you're trying to distance yourself from. Don't be afraid to make all or none decisions. You say, okay, well, what decisions should I make? Well, that's not my job. I already told you. But we do have a number of resources for you. I'll tell you about some of them because when I travel and speak, people say, well, you know, let us know what you have. But I want to tell you, first of all, about some free things that I'd like you to take advantage of. So during this speaking tour, I was just finishing up reviewing. I was hoping it would be done by already uploaded, but we're just finishing up a video called Beyond Immune Enhancement. Beyond Immune Enhancement. We're speaking on this topic in some venues throughout Central Florida. But if you would like to watch this new video, it's a free video that we're releasing on YouTube. Hopefully it will be uploaded tonight. I've got to finish reviewing it. It's about a half an hour long. But if everything looks good, it will be uploaded tonight. We will send you information about that if you request either of the free gifts that I'm telling you about, because we'll ask for your email. If you give a fake email, you won't get the link to the new video, but that's okay. You don't have to give us a true email if you're afraid that we're going to be spying on you or something. So the first free gift I want to tell you about is right here. It's a book called Evading Ebola. Now, if you would like, I think you can go right now onto Amazon and you can pay $10 for a soft cover edition of this book. If you say that sounds like a lot of money for a book that's less than 100 pages, you can buy it out at the resource table for $5. But if you want an ebook, we will give it to you for free. All you've got to do is memorize my website. Let me help you. My website is designed to point people to better health. What device could you use to point you to better health, metaphorically speaking? What can point you in the right direction? If you're traveling, what do you use? GPS? You're on the right track. It's a compass. That's what I'm looking for. Okay? So compass, we're trying to direct you to what? Health. Compass health. Okay? Compass health. That's all you got to remember. That's the website. And you say, well, wait a minute. Don't all the websites have a dot something? It's compasshealth.what? Com is a very good guess, but it's incorrect. Anyone else want to guess? .org, that's an excellent guess. Also incorrect. Where are we right now? We're in a church. We're in a church. I want to tell you something. Do you know that Jesus had a plan for his followers? He said he was going to make them blank of men. Fishers of men. What do you fish with? A net. CompassHealth.net. Come on, think about it. You don't fish with an org or a com. CompassHealth.net. Now, if you can remember that, you go to our website. We have lots of free resources there. And if you go to our website, CompassHealth.net, you will not be able to get this free book. You say, wait a minute. I thought you said if we memorize your website, you get the free book. Well, it's a special free offer. You have to know that there's a special slash that you have to put after the website. You have to go compasshealth.net/, and if you want a book on Ebola, what do you think the magic word you have to put after the slash is? Ebola, that's right. We're not just giving this to anybody, okay? Now, we do offer it in some other places, but we're especially offering it on this tour throughout Central Florida. So if you want the book, compasshealth.net/Ebola, and this book is yours free. Let me tell you about another free resource that we've got. It is a 15-page handout on immune enhancement. We use a framework of the sanctuary. Now, when I say the word sanctuary, depending on who the person is, they may think, I don't know about that. I've heard about these sanctuary cities. Some people think they're really good. Other people don't like them. It probably depends on what aisle you sit in politically, okay? Whether you like sanctuary cities or not, most people have heard of sanctuary in that context. Other people think of wildlife sanctuaries and bird sanctuaries. In a church, some people think, well, sanctuary, that's what we call the church, or that's something that God had his people build for him in the wilderness, a sanctuary. Whatever you think of, if you can remember the word sanctuary, it's the mnemonic. It's a memory device we use for 9 elements of a immune-enhancing lifestyle. CompassHealth.net/sanctuary, and you will get a free 15-page handout on natural things, practical things you can do to improve your immune system. Fair enough? Okay, so those are the free gifts that we have for you. We also have some other resources, and you've been hearing about our blood pressure book. I didn't check. If some of you want to check, maybe it slipped off the top 10 blood pressure titles on Amazon, but it's often among the top 10 selling books on blood pressure on Amazon. This book we have tonight on special for $15. It lists for $19.95. Sometimes Amazon has it cheaper, other times it's more expensive. But if you want it signed tonight, you better buy it here. Buy it on Amazon. I don't care if you have the Amazon Prime. It won't come in time for me to sign it this evening. So that is a 30-day program, 30 days to natural blood pressure control. And let me just ask you a question. What percentage of Americans do you think have high blood pressure? 80? Well, here's the answer. It depends. We've got some interesting graphics in the book. You'll see one of them in chapter 2 there. Chapter 1 and 2, some really interesting data. Let me make it real simple for you. Here in America, even using older guidelines that are not as strict, once you have your 60th birthday, your age is roughly the percentage of the population that has high blood pressure. So if you're 65, what percentage of 65-year-olds in America have high blood pressure? 65%. If you're 85, what percentage of 85-year-olds have high blood pressure? 85%. If you are 102, what percentage of 102-year-olds have high blood pressure? No, it's not 102%, right? Here's what we used to say. Up until about 5 years ago, when I would speak to groups, I would say, really, basically, there's only two groups of people. One group of people has high blood pressure now, and what's the other group? That's right, the ones who are going to get high blood pressure before they die, really. And that was a pretty accurate description, a little bit of poetic license there. But in fairness, as of about 5 years ago, to be fair, we have to say there's a third group. What is the third group? What? No, not quite. So there's those who have high blood pressure now, those who are going to develop it, and what is the third group? It's those who have read our book. Okay? Okay. So whether you have high blood pressure or not, or whether you know someone, that's a resource for you. Now, I found something out after writing that book that a lot of people said, I love to learn, but I hate to read. So we were really nice, and we actually got a professional, award-winning reader, professional reader. Some of you may have heard this person, famous name. I would be surprised if there's anyone in this room who has not heard of this individual, who we got to read this book. His name is Dr. David D. Rose. You heard of him? And so I read the entire book. It's over 12 hours on 10 CDs. If you're an Audible member, you can download it. But if you're not and you want it on CDs, we have that resource. By the way, everything tonight is on special for you folks. In spite of all that, people said, if you read the reviews, there's, I don't know, probably 400 or 500 reviews on Amazon. 4.2 stars, something like that. So, you know, generally very well-regarded book. A lot of people telling us how their blood pressures come down, how they followed the program. I've met many people who that has helped them. But I still found people having an issue. They said, yeah, it's a 30-day program. You tell us, you know, you give us guidelines. But I want to know exactly what to do every single day. And we didn't do that in the book. So I said, okay. And we released a free video series a year or two after the book came out, and we expanded it, not just to deal with blood pressure, but also with diabetes, and we called it 30 Days to Natural Diabetes and High Blood Pressure Control. And if you go to a very significant website that hopefully you've all memorized, you can actually access this free. Have any of you ever heard of my website? What is it? CompassHealth.net. You are a very bright group. You know, I'm giving a lecture at Forest Lake Church on Wednesday night. All of you probably could skip that lecture because it's on brain health. And you're demonstrating just, you know, very, very good cognitive powers, at least those of you that spoke up. If some of you are still looking bewildered about what I'm talking about, you definitely need to be there Wednesday night, okay? So anyway, we came out with this video series. If you go to CompassHealth.net, go to Help for High Blood Pressure, and the first thing you'll see is a picture of our book. Scroll down below the book, and you will see links to the free YouTube videos, about a 5-minute video every day for 30 days, where you can go on a new lifestyle program. By the way, it would not be a bad idea if you went on that journey with someone else. And that brings us to the next point I want to make tonight. Because if you're wanting to be successful when it comes to lifestyle change, what we know is you're most likely to be successful if you don't do it alone. Now, I know this is not a huge group here tonight, but if you came alone here tonight, I want to encourage you not to leave without making a friend. And you say, wait a minute, this is, you know, COVID-19 time, Dr. DeRose. I mean, we don't want to get too close to people. Stay 6 feet away, you know, keep your mask on, and or shout across the room and say, you look like I've never met you. And they say, take off the mask, silly, I'm your brother, okay? But anyway, whatever the case may be, make a friend before you leave. And what I would recommend you do, whether you go to that free 30-day program or whether you use some of the other resources or whether you take advantage of things that are happening right here in this faith community, I would tell you, do it with someone else. Go on the journey with someone else. A lot of people are afraid to do that. I've noticed over the years, if you're going to make a bold lifestyle decision, many people tell me, I would rather just keep it a secret. Why do you think that is? That's right. If you fail, I mean, how is that going to look if you told other people about it, right? Like if you said, I'm never walking through McDonald's again. And sure enough, there you are. You're walking to McDonald's and someone's tooting the horn, waving at you, right? See ya. I knew you couldn't do it, right? Just keep it a secret, right? But that behaviorally doesn't hold up. And in fact, as a society, we know that the things that are most important in society, we do in public. Have you ever noticed this? Now, I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but there's a good chance that there's some people in this room who've been married. When people get married, I mean, you know the data, right? I mean, marriages, the majority of them don't survive. I mean, wouldn't it be better if you just didn't tell anyone, just got married in secret, then if the marriage didn't work out, I mean, no one's asking, well, you know, I thought you guys just got married, or, you know, what happened? Wouldn't it be easier just to keep it a secret? Why do we get married in public, and why do we invite people to weddings? Well, one of the reasons is it increases the likelihood that you'll stay together, because you value this, and you make a public statement of your commitment. Now, I'm kind of looking around here. I've been in many churches over the years, and I've noticed some churches, and probably somewhere around this church, knowing what I do about the Apopka Seventh-day Adventist Church, there's probably some type of large tank, if you will, that they often fill with water. Is this correct? What do you guys call that around here? A baptistry, okay? So I know the Seventh-day Adventist Church teaches that they believe in adult baptism by immersion. That is biblical. I mean, Jesus, after all, when he was baptized by John, he didn't sprinkle him with water by the Jordan, right? He brought him under the river. The Bible says when he came out of the water, okay? So, yeah. So here they baptize people. Now, let me just ask you a question. Do you baptize people in secret here, or do you do it in public? Well, why do you do that? I mean, some people are nervous. You know, there's a lot of people sometimes in a church. Wouldn't it be easier on the baptismal candidate just to do it in secret? Why do you do it in public? Okay, so there's accountability. You're committing to be part of a body, right? And this increases the likelihood of your success, of being part of the community and continuing to maintain what you've taken a public stand for. So here's why I'm talking about this. I want to challenge you. 2021 is here. I would like to see this to be a year of better health for everyone in this room. And what it's going to take is to realize some of the things I've been talking with you about. It's going to take realizing that you don't have to fear giving up your bad habits because you thought they were bringing great meaning to your life. Because you can be healthy and you can be happy. That's really the same pathway. I've also told you that you shouldn't be afraid of making clean breaks, breaking free from certain things completely. But now I'm telling you one of the other secrets is you want to go on the journey with someone else. And so whether you pick up, we got a number of educational video series here, and some people will watch these in their home. We've got one on infectious diseases. If you say 15-page handout, I'll never read that. Well, you could get our series, Natural Strategies for Infectious Diseases, 2 one-hour presentations. Watch it with someone else, and as you watch it, say, what am I going to do differently? If you don't come to my Brain Health Revolution lecture, probably more than we'll be able to cover in the lectures here, 2 one-hour presentations on practical things you can do to improve your brain health. Watch it with someone else. Or watch it yourself and then share it with someone else. If you don't like the blood pressure books and the audio books and you don't like the 5-minute videos, I have 3 one-hour presentations on naturally lowering blood pressure. So we've got a lot on blood pressure. It's such a big problem trying to help people on that front. Have you ever heard of changing bad habits for good? So we all have this presentation a bit different, because it's always a little bit different, but a lot of the illustrations and things and more in this two-part video series that we have available for you as well. If you want to share your experience tonight, of course, you can have them watch the link, but more material in there than we're actually covering this evening. So you say, okay, but I still want to know exactly what to do and how to do it. I put those 30 videos out with that in mind, and then I said, as I was working on another book, I said, you know what? Let's take those same 30 principles that relate to preventing or treating diabetes and high blood pressure, and let's put it in this new book that just recently came out, The Methuselah Factor. What is the publication date on here? Let's see. make sure I'm telling you the truth, that it's really a recent book. 2019, okay, that qualifies. So, the Methuselah factor. This book is about improving your blood fluidity. You say, improving my blood fluidity? Why would I be interested in that? It's amazing, actually. It's the technical science called hemorheology. It's the science of blood fluidity. What we find, first 13 chapters in this book tell you all the things that are connected with having better blood fluidity. Now, I'll just walk you through the list. If you have better blood fluidity, you'll have less risk of heart attack, less risk of stroke. Go through all the medical evidence for it. You'll have less risk of visual impairment. If you have concerns about macular degeneration or glaucoma, the research shows if you improve your blood fluidity, you decrease your risk of these conditions. You have less risk of certain types of cancer. Your mind tends to function better, better mental clarity, less risk of dementia. Your blood pressure will tend to be better. If you have diabetes, you'll have less risk of complications. You'll be more likely to lose weight or not gain weight if you're at a good weight. It helps your bone and joint health, it delays aging, and it improves physical performance. You say, no way, it couldn't do all those things. True story, when I was in medical school, they told me, if they say something cures everything, you can be sure it probably cures nothing. Okay? But actually, we have the scientific evidence for all those things. That's the first 13 chapters of the book. The last 30 chapters are a day-by-day program. Simple, practical things you can do. By the way, each of the daily goals in this book is the same as on the free videos for high blood pressure and diabetes. Give me a day between 1 and 30, and I'll walk you through it. Give me a number. 15. That was the first one I heard. And it just so happened, did you know I was open to 15? Oh, okay. So day 15, here's today's challenge. If you are overweight, add another specific element to your daily program to help you trim down. And in that chapter, we give other suggestions that you can do to lose weight. And here's one of them. Let's see if you've ever heard anything like this. Make clean breaks with problem foods and habits. Have you ever heard of that? You heard it right here. Here's another one. Increase your exercise. Say, Dr. DeRose, I knew that. How about this one? Forget about your goal weight. Forget about your goal weight. And you say, wait a minute, that sounds dangerous. And I actually share something I learned right here in Orlando. I used to actually be the medical director for a program that back then we called it Florida Hospital, had a weight loss program. And I noticed something very interesting. Many people would set a goal for weight loss. They'd come through our program, and they'd be doing great. Maybe they needed to lose, they thought, 150 pounds, okay? Someone 5'3", they wanted to get down to 150, and they weighed 300. They lost 100 pounds. So what does that put them at? From 300 to 200. But what was their goal? 150. And for some reason, they're plateauing around 200. And you know what? I saw so many people with that same plot line. You know what they would do? They'd say, I'm never going to get to 150. Just forget about it. Forget the exercise. Forget the diet. I'm just going to go back to my old lifestyle. And I said, what? That's terrible. And then you see them. They quit the program. And you see them at, you still have Albertsons here? What do you have now? Publix? Oh, yeah. We had Publix back then, too. So you go to Publix, and what do? You see them, and they look like they weigh 350. Here's the point. Focus on your lifestyle, not on what the scale is showing. And here's the really interesting thing I noticed, that a lot of people, they had goal weights. They might have been unrealistic, but also they were goal weights, maybe what they weighed when they were 12 years old. But they weren't on a good lifestyle 12 years old. So they might be able to weigh 30 pounds more and wear those clothes that they could wear when they were much lighter in the past because they're exercising and they've toned up and they're eating better. Do you get the picture? Anyway, so we have pointers like that throughout the book. And some folks said, well, yeah, it's all interesting. The videos are interesting, but I don't have diabetes or high blood pressure. I wish there was a program for me, a 30-day program. Well, we do have that. So we actually redid those videos and made them broader. They're a little bit longer than 5 minutes. I think they're all under 10 minutes. Maybe there's an exception. And this is based directly on the Methuselah Factor program, so people can pick up the book if they want some videos with me coaching them through the program. We go through 30 daily presentations. I think it's a great resource. If you're wanting to make changes in 2021, pick up either a copy of the book or the videos or both, and maybe pick up a few copies. I don't know anywhere you can get them cheaper than here tonight, and go on the journey with someone else. We have an overview of the Methuselah Factor here, 2 one-hour presentations. If you feel that the book is too laborious and you don't want 30 daily videos, this is an overview of the whole program, 2 one-hour presentations. We've got some other things on diabetes. I'll tell you about one other resource here. This is a video called Spiritual Health, Neglected Dimensions. This is a really interesting one. It's actually based on chapter 14 in our blood pressure book, because we found that spiritual principles widely supported in the medical research literature. And Dr. Greg Steinke and I did this presentation together. It also includes some other bonus presentations, a half-hour overview on blood pressure. So just a lot of things here to help you achieve your goals in 2021. Having said all that, one last thing I will mention, because we're in a church. This is a series that I did a little while back called Healing Insights from the Gospel of Mark. So these are 8 half-hour presentations, and they're designed for a home Bible study group, a church Bible study, a prayer meeting. You can go through these. I draw out health lessons from the Gospel of Mark, 30 minutes each presentation. Now, the nice thing about this is there's an amazing website that has free resources that goes along with this video series. Would any of you like to guess what the amazing website is? CompassHealth.net. You are a very insightful group. If you go to CompassHealth.net, under our free resources, you will find depression helps to go along with this, over 100 pages if you want to use them. And if you're leading out a discussion or you're leading out a group and you want to go through the look at it from the standpoint of health, that's a resource for you. So, I put in your hands not only some of the key concepts that we use when we're changing behaviors, but also some of the resources that we have. And I want to spend our last 20 minutes or so taking your questions. So if any of you need to slip out, you're welcome to do that. But I know there's a lot of opportunity for some good dialogue. I see a couple of mics up here. I wouldn't be surprised if there's someone who's willing to help us and run those mics around the room and allow us to get to know what's on your mind. Okay, I've got some folks coming up to help us, and I am going to open up my bag that has one of our secrets to immune enhancement, as well as improved hemorheology. It is right here. Some of you may have seen these before. It's surprising to me how many people are underhydrated. Really makes a difference. Okay, who's got a question for us? Okay, I see one in back. We've got a microphone headed your way. Young lady in the back there. Okay. Hello, good to see you here tonight.
So I have a question. How much, in your experience, does culture plays in how compliant we are with changing our habits?
Okay, great question. So how does culture fit into this whole equation of changing habits? Tell you some stories about this. And you probably could tell me your own stories. But I've noticed as I've traveled to different places in the world that people are very kind in general, especially when you're their guest. And they'll offer you some of the finest food they have in their country. When I'm doing group discussion, I've worked with groups and helping them go on this journey of changing lifestyle. And I've asked them the question, what kind of things have you experienced in different cultures when it comes to special foods? And some people would tell me interesting things. Like they said, well, when I was in this particular culture, they gave me the best soup. And that soup had the eyeballs floating in it, okay? And so I asked the question, well, how was it? And they said, oh, it was just disgusting, okay? And I heard so many stories of things that were so distasteful that were the best foods that they had to offer. And the question becomes, well, why is that? Why in one culture do they think something is so delicious, and then when someone from a different culture eats it, it might be totally unpalatable? And part of it has to do with this dynamic that we've been talking about. We have the capacity to develop enjoyments. Unfortunately, none of us made our decisions initially for ourselves, right? My parents didn't just take me into a grocery store when I was, a year and a half and let me pull down whatever came off the shelf and, you know, make something. They made things that grew out of their culture. So in our cultures, we grow up identifying with certain foods. That's really interesting to me, because often our cultural identity can be tied to certain foods. Now, I think you asked the question because you saw up here on this pile that I didn't tell you anything about one of the videos. So thank you for making sure I mention this. This video series is called Listening to the Buffalo. And some of you may know, the syndicated radio show that I have is called American Indian and Alaska Native Living. I've worked closely with many indigenous American peoples for many years. And this is a video series. Well, let me just tell you what it's about. It says, from the example of Native Americans, gain insights and motivation to help you lose weight, prevent or better control diabetes, lower your cholesterol, boost your energy level, reduce your blood pressure, and more. Now, why am I mentioning this in response to this question? Because I want to tell you about one of the foods that many Native Americans will tell you is our native unity food. Do you know what it is? It's fry bread. Okay? Fry bread. Have you had fry bread before? Okay, think lots of fat and flour, okay? And you get the picture. Now, here's the interesting thing. This native unity food was never eaten by indigenous Americans until after European contact. So let me tell you where I'm going with this. If I'm working with Native Americans who have diabetes, do you know one of the foods that drive diabetes? What is the food category, the single food category that is most driving the diabetes epidemic? Do you know? It's actually fat, even more so than sugar, and especially saturated fat. Why? Because saturated fat is solid at room temperature, and the fats that you eat become incorporated into your tissues. Think about it. When you eat saturated fat, your cells have more rigid cell membranes. And where your neurotransmitters work and where your insulin receptors are, they're on the cell membrane. A more rigid cell membrane is not as responsive to chemical messages. So here I'm working with Native Americans, and I'm talking with them about diabetes. And I'm saying, if you want to break free from the diabetes, one of the things you've got to decrease, ideally leave out, are fried foods. And what do they think? My culture, my unity food. You're telling me not to be native. Until they learn, and they read from native authors, like Dr. Yvonne Jackson, who we quote in the series. Native Americans never ate fried food prior to European contact. So here's the interesting thing when we talk about culture. Often we have cultural things that we say, well, this is my culture. But sometimes, it's just interesting to me, and most of the time is what I've found, if you go back to your cultural roots, back to wherever your people originally came from, indigenous people groups throughout the world were surprisingly healthy. I mean, think about it. They would have died out long ago if they weren't. So most of the foundations of indigenous lifestyle are healthy. Now, I'm not going to say I'm going to endorse everything, but it's amazing. So if you go back and someone says, well, you're not really, my roots are Italian, okay? And so I grew up, there was always in the house, there was wine. There was always alcohol there. There was always cheese there. There was always white pasta, okay? By the way, right now I don't eat any of those things. Well, white pasta, I choose not to eat it, but you know, if you served it to me, I'd eat it. But here's the thing. Someone could say to me, "You're not an Italian. You don't eat cheese. You're not drinking wine. How can you call yourself an Italian?" Well, if you go back in history, can you go back far enough where Italians weren't eating wine and cheese? I don't know. But I know I can go back far enough where they were eating lots of plant foods, even if they were having a little bit of wine and a little bit of cheese. Take my grandfather Santo. He grew up eating lots of tomatoes and lots of eggplant and lots of garlic and lots of onions and lots of grapes. You get the picture. So here's the point. Yes, culture can present challenges. And some of the things in the culture may go very far back. But a lot of things that we perceive to be cultural, we can tap into our culture for practices that were healthier that our same cultural group embraced. So it's not, you know, this white guy talking to native people about how they should eat. It's saying, connect with the own cultural wisdom that you have that goes back before white guys came to this continent. Okay? What about other questions tonight? Okay, we have one up here in the front.
I realize your retinology is not your specialty, but I was interested in your comment about body fluidity and decreasing the risk of macular degeneration. I don't wonder if you'd comment a little bit more about macular degeneration and what if one already has it.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about eye health. So what we know today is that the leading cause of vision loss in America among adults is actually diabetes. If you don't have diabetes, or if you have diabetes and are able to evade eye complications, the two most likely things that are going to claim your vision, or at least two of the very likely things that could claim it, are macular degeneration and glaucoma. In chapter 5, the title is Improve Your Methuselah Factor, Decrease Your Risk of Visual Impairment. What we have here are epidemiologic studies. So these are studies among population groups that have looked at connections between macular degeneration and glaucoma and markers of blood fluidity. And what we find is the better your blood fluidity, the less risk you have of these conditions. Now, I will be honest with you. This is an overview book, okay? You're right. It's not, we don't, this, the chapters are short. We've tried to make this for lay people, and we don't go into any great discussion about, you know, if you have macular degeneration, will this reverse it? I do not have that expertise. But the point I'm making is the research is very clear. What I'm calling the Methuselah factor, do you know why I call it that? The Methuselah factor? Why don't we just call it optimal hemorheology? In fact, I've given I gave a six-hour series to physicians on hemorheology. Why don't we just call it that? Well, I found something interesting. I'd give a lecture to a lay group on hemorheology, and they'd leave. And someone would ask them, well, what were you doing? Well, I went to hear Dr. DeRose. It was an amazing talk. Well, what was it on? It was all about you understand, is a lot of people had trouble remembering hemorheology. So we said, you know what? There's this character in the Bible. His name was Methuselah. Do you know anything about Methuselah in the Bible? That's right. He was the oldest living person on this planet. So although we have no records, no medical records from Methuselah, I can guarantee you he had very good blood fluidity. Okay? So the Methuselah factor is the secrets of optimal blood fluidity. And we know there's a connection with eye health. I don't know if there's been a study where they've actually tried to, I would love for some retinologists to say, you know what, we're going to give all our patients, we're going to give half our patients with macular degeneration Dr. DeRosa's book. We'll have a counselor, and they'll go through this program, and we'll follow them for a year and see if their markers of macular degeneration improve. I think there's a good chance they would. But can I prove that? No, because we haven't done the research. Okay? So great question. Sorry I couldn't give you a more definitive answer. Anything else tonight? Okay.
Do you have any other specific advice for staying healthy in the pandemic other than what you've already told us?
Well, we do have a lot. And some of the things that you want to prioritize are in the free book, the Methuselah Factor book. Others are in the immune system handout that's also free. Remember, compasshealth.net/Ebola is for the free book. How do you get the 15-page handout?
Sanctuary.
compasshealth.net/sanctuary. But let me tell you a few of them that you want to definitely keep in mind. One of them is vitamin D. It is one of the single most important lifestyle factors when it comes to immune system health and being clearly linked to more successful outcomes from COVID-19. Very, very important. So people say, well, yeah, it's important, but I'm taking vitamin D. I looked at my multivitamin, and it says it has vitamin D, and you look down, and it's 100 international units a day. Is that enough? What we find, in order for people just to maintain their levels, most people need at least 1,000 to 2,000 international units a day. If you don't know your level, no cases in the literature that I've seen of anyone taking less than 10,000 international units a day getting toxic. So we recommend, if we're starting someone out on a vitamin D program and haven't been able to assess their vitamin D level, we have them start with 5,000 international units a day. I like to measure vitamin D levels in my patients. If their level's low, let's say your level's 8. By the way, it should be at least 30. I like to see at least 30. If it's down, you know, 5 or 8, I'm going to give someone 50 to 100,000 units a week. Okay? So don't say, well, I'm taking 5,000 a day. Well, that may not be enough if your level's really low. But I don't want you going out and taking 50,000 units a day because you can get toxic, okay? So vitamin D you can get too much of. So it's very important for optimal immune functioning. You've also heard, we talk about it in the book here, Evading Ebola. Actually, a really good study. Let me see if I can find it quickly here. A real big one, by the way, is stress management. So I hope I haven't stressed you guys out tonight. This one here is really interesting. So we have a chapter on nutrition. We have a chapter on regular physical exercise. I like this study. By the way, a lot of this is in our new video, too, Beyond Immune Enhancement. And if you request one of the free resources, you're supposed to be, that email address is supposed to go into our preferred contact list, and we'll be sending out, hopefully next day or two, the link to all our preferred contacts, letting you know about the new resource. So that mailing list, pretty sporadically used, but when we come out with new things, we'll often let people know about what's available. But exercise, this is a study from Dr. David Neiman and colleagues at Appalachian State University, done about a decade ago. They recruited over 1,000 people. It's on page 55 in the book. And really interesting study. They looked at people during the winter cold and flu season. And they looked at what happened to individuals who were exercising daily or near daily, at least 5 times a week, and compared them to those who were not exercising at all or exercising very seldom, 1 or fewer days per week. They found roughly a 50% decrease in symptomatic cold and flu symptoms. And what we're thinking, you know, what works with these other viral illnesses, in fact, if you think about it, COVID-19 is a coronavirus. And a lot of the colds that we've had over the years have been caused by coronaviruses. There's rhinoviruses and other things that cause common cold symptoms. But the bottom line is a good reason to believe that physical activity, daily outdoor exercise. In fact, one of my favorite authors wrote a book called The Ministry of Healing. If you don't have a copy, talk with someone here. They can probably get you a copy. But that author spoke about the benefit, the far-reaching benefits of morning exercise outside. Still good science. We got a question there.
Yes, I have a question. If you're already taking vitamin D, is there something else that you should be taking that helps it absorb better?
Okay. Yeah, let's talk about absorption of vitamin D. So vitamin D is a fat-soluble vitamin. And what clinicians have found is you'll tend to absorb vitamin D best if you take it with fat. So we always recommend that you take it with a meal. And some are in an oil matrix or in a gel cap or something. Others are in a powder form. Especially if it's in a powder form, eat it with some nuts or sprinkle it on your peanut butter or in your, take it with something fatty, okay? And that will generally tend to enhance the absorption of the vitamin D. Vitamin D3 tends to be absorbed better than vitamin D2. Vitamin D3 is actually the vitamin D that your body makes, so we do recommend if you're not using a D3, you use a D3. So those are some of the things that we would recommend.
What about an MK something supplement?
Are you familiar with that? I'm not sure what that is.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not connecting anything
vitamin
with that.
K.
Or is it a vitamin K maybe?
Oh, vitamin
does
K.
Does that help absorb?
Well, vitamin K does have a role in bone health. I haven't seen it reported to help with vitamin D absorption. Vitamin K is a dangerous one to take if you're on some of the older blood thinners like warfarin. So if you're on a Coumadin or warfarin, you do not want to take vitamin K unless you're consulting with your physician. Now, there's some rare cases where we may give vitamin K and Coumadin as well, but that's unusual. Okay, you definitely don't want to be taking it without a doctor's supervision.
Thank you.
We got a question in back. Can we get a microphone back there? So our time is slipping away. We will finish up in about 5 minutes. If you have individual questions for me, I'm going to go out to the resource. Judy's going to make some final comments at the end of the presentation. I will slip out. I'll go out back by the resource table. If you're getting books as gifts or just for yourself and you would like me to sign something, I'm happy to do that. If you have individual questions, I'll take them as well. Please, your question.
In reference to genetics, so let's say you're doing everything right. What is the part that genetics plays with, let's say, diabetes or osteoporosis or something like that?
Genetics has a huge place to play, but what we know today is that it's not just genetics, it's also what we call epigenetics. So we're dealt a genetic hand, if you will, given to us by our mother and father, but our lifestyle has the ability to turn genes on and off. Now, there are some genes that you really can't turn off, okay? I mean, if you're given a 3 chromosome 21 instead of 2, you will have Down syndrome, okay? You can't turn off a whole chromosome. But even in a case like that, you can still modulate gene expression by lifestyle. So this is why there's such an emphasis on lifestyle today. And just really simply, one person who looked at this in a very interesting context was Dr. Dean Ornish. Dr. Ornish was looking at treating prostate cancer naturally. And he actually found that when men with prostate cancer actually got on a comprehensive healthy lifestyle, it actually switched off many of the cancer genes. So we can modulate or alter gene expression. Of course, sometimes, certain genes are just so powerful that they will cause something. But we can often forestall. Most of the chronic diseases are not single gene related, and we can forestall those. For example, if you have sickle cell anemia, you can't, by changing your lifestyle, change the sickling of the cells. You can still affect your blood fluidity and affect your, risk of events, of crises. Okay, we have just a few minutes. One final burning question. Okay, can we get a mic up to the front row? This will be our last question. Then Judy will have some final remarks. Yeah, right up in front here.
Yes, I've heard that depending on the blood type that you have, it could be more favorable to not contracting COVID. Mm-hmm. Do you concur with that, or how much?
Yeah, there is evidence that type O blood provides some protection. That is one of the genetic things we can't modulate by lifestyle. So if you are type O, you do have a bit less risk. But you shouldn't be complacent. By the way, if you're a woman, we know that women are at less risk of severe COVID-19 infection than men. Some people think that has to do with testosterone being adverse. But bottom line, again, although we may try to manipulate some of these things with hormones, genetically, can't change your gender, can't change your blood type. Good question, though, okay? Judy, why don't you finish up for us?
Thank you so much, Dr. DeRose.
You're welcome.
And thank you, everyone, for coming. Now, I know some of you are going to want to line up and look at those books. I just ask that you be a bit careful with how close we're getting to each other, because we want to continue to do our 6 feet, maybe a little bit difficult, but as best we can, we want to follow the rules that are out there. So actually, let's go ahead and just finish with a real short prayer, and then we'll be dismissed. Father God, thank you so much for the fact that we had the opportunity for Dr. DeRose to come and speak with us here. Lord, give us courage to put those habits into place that will make a difference in our lives. Keep us healthy. Keep us close to you, we ask. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, everyone, have a wonderful week, and good to have you here.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. International copyright, all rights reserved. Free listing of this message and over 7,000 other presentations by more than 100 speakers on 50 different topics is now available on our American Christian Ministries mobile app for Android and Apple devices, and on our secure website, or call 800-233-4450. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help to prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.